I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is cultural theorist, philosopher, novelist, and writer of the Ethicist column in the New York Times, Kwame Anthony Appiah. He's joined in conversation by Clara Jeffery, editor-in-chief of Mother Jones. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Kwame Anthony Appiah and Clara Jeffery.
Kwame Anthony Appiah is one of our country's leading thinkers on identity. A professor of philosophy and law at NYU, he also writes the New York Times Magazine's Ethicist column, answering readers' questions on a wide variety of common but thorny problems of modern life. The former president of the Pan American Center, he's the author of The Ethics of Identity, Thinking It Through, An Introduction to Contemporary Philosophy, The Honor Code, and the prize-winning Cosmopolitanism. His latest book is The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity. Appearing in conversation with Anthony is Clara Jeffery. Clara is the award-winning editor-in-chief of the very wonderful Mother Jones, which was named Magazine of the Year by the American Society of Magazine Editors in 2017. Please join me in giving Anthony and Clara a very warm welcome to the JCCSF.
I'm very glad to be here tonight with you, Anthony, and with all of you. As Stephanie mentioned, Kwame Anthony Appiah's book, The Lies That Bind Us, Rethinking Identity, has just been published. And in it, he argues that the categories that we assign to ourselves and others, be it gender, race, creed, or nationality, are more changeable and contradictory than essential. But while mistaken ideas about identity have led to some of the world's greatest atrocities, identities aren't things we can shrug off entirely. Indeed, they can be leveraged for social good. This last week has been just horrific for the violence leveled at people for their identity. We saw pipe bombs being sent to prominent Democrats and journalists. A white man gunned down two African Americans at a drugstore after failing to gain entry to a black church. The Trump administration is trying to erase trans people with the stroke of a pen. And yesterday, the worst act of anti-Semitic violence ever to occur on American soil took the lives of eight congregants of the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and injured six others, including four police officers who charged in to keep the carnage from being worse. The JCC is one of San Francisco's and one of the country's greatest Jewish civic institutions. And this morning I took comfort in reading, and forgive my mispronunciation that I'm sure will occur, but the Sheva Mido, the seven core values that are in the atrium here, and particularly one for which an Anne Frank quote is presented as its exemplar. How wonderful it is that nobody need wait a single moment before starting to improve the world. All good people are mourning these tragedies and must also fight the forces that have unleashed them. Peace be unto you. I suppose as we're about to get into a conversation about identity, I should just lay mine on the table. I'm a cit-het-ish woman. I'm white. I'm an atheist Quaker. I'm a journalist, I'm a mom, I'm an American, and I'm a California transplant. Are all these identities in some ways constructed?
Mom, of course, you were made by...
I actually did that.
You did that. But what it means, that's constructed, mm-hmm. and it's constructed differently in different places. So, mums matter. Well, for example, there's no word in my father's language for mother that doesn't also refer to your mother's sister. Mm. If you want to say mother, you have to say the one I came out of, the mother I came out of, because the other, your mother's sisters, are also your mothers. So that's a different way of thinking about motherhood.
It's a matrilineal society.
It's a matrilineal society, which means that also it means for men that the children in your life are your sister's children, not your wife's children. And since I'm gay, that's good for me because I have three sisters. And I get a lot of grandchildren. I get all their children and their children's children without doing the work. So So, I think the point is, you know, I'm just saying that it seems to me right to think of all these things as, on the one hand, there's a sort of fact at the base of it, mm-hmm. either the child came out of you or it didn't.
Yeah.
But what we do with it is up to us to a certain extent. And so we should be thoughtful about what we do with it.
Your book begins with an account of how those that you casually meet, cab driver or waiter, whatever, struggle to categorize you. How do you categorize yourself?
It depends what I'm being asked to do, or who's asking and why. I mean, in the great catalog of the primary social identities, I'm a cis man, I'm gay, I'm an Anglo-Ghanaian American, I'm an ex-Anglican, and ex-Anglicans are basically a kind of Anglican. Have I left something important out? I'm a philosopher. I think my professional identity is kind of important to me. But all of those, I'm hoping that I've done something with that's not exactly the same as anybody else.
You mentioned that you're a professor of philosophy and that you're descendant from, or I'll add this in, from British and Ghanaian aristocracy. Your husband is the editorial director of The New Yorker. You're ridiculously well-educated. You celebrate cosmopolitanism and a pluralistic society. Does that make you a card-carrying member of the global elite?
You don't need a card.
Okay.
One of the things that I added to the book that wasn't in the lectures that the book is based on is a long discussion of class. I am fantastically conscious of the privileges of class that I have grown up with. That education I had because I had family that could get me into excellent schools, and I went to Cambridge University, which I wouldn't have gotten into if my parents hadn't been able to get me into the schools that led up to Cambridge, and if we hadn't had a house full of books when I was growing up. That's a very big deal, because in my hometown, there literally probably were a dozen people who had as many books as we had. And it's the second biggest town in Ghana. Our collection of books in our house was the library of our street. All the kids on the street. And my mother had a huge collection of children's books because she was a children writer. She wrote children's books. All the kids on our street came and sat and read books with us. So if you grow up with books, if you get sent to very, very good schools, and if you, my uncle and great uncle were kings, my grandfather, my great grandfather was the first Labour leader of the House of Lords. It's kind of a nice mixture. So, first socialist leader of the most reactionary political institution in Britain apart from the monarchy. And my grandfather was the Chancellor of the Exchequer who, in the government that built the modern post-war welfare state in Britain. So I have to sort of think about that whenever I say these things about how I think we can live, because many of these things are much, much easier for me to say than they would be for somebody else. So I can have a kind of racial identity that sits relatively lightly on me, because I can use class privilege and my education and the money that I get as a well-paid professor to protect myself.
The buffer.
From the damage that is done every day to poor people of color in this country, for whom it's sort of absurd to suggest that they can let it sit lightly on them. They can't let it sit lightly on them because the world is sitting it heavily on them. So I try always to remember when I say the things I do about these things that you need to remember that the point you made at the start, which is that these identities can be very important sources of, among other things, resistance to oppression, and that saying to someone, oh, you should be relaxed about racial identity, if their racial identity is what they're using to resist oppression, is, foolish.
You know, our attempts to categorize ourselves and others are thought in some sense to be evolutionary, sort of my clan versus your clan, I got the resources, stay away. But in today's world, this too often seems to be manifesting itself as toxic political tribalism and the sort of implicit bias that is implicated in police shootings, among other things. How can we rise above the worst part of our instinct to categorize?
So I should have said at the start when you asked me about identity that I'm a Democrat with a big D. as well as with a small d. So I do have a strong political identity myself. But I think that when I find myself, as it were, taking pleasure in the discomfiture of conservatives or Republicans, I try to pull myself back from that because it's okay to disagree with people. It's okay to think that I have the right, me and mine have the right idea about what to do. It's not okay to take pleasure in the fact that other people are upset by the fact that what I think is the best thing has happened. Democracy's not going to work that way. Mm. What are our resources for doing something about it? Well, first, the identities that divide us are only some of the identities that we have. I think that's a really important point. Anybody in the world that I am divided from by some national, racial, religious, gender, sexuality, cis-trans thing, there's something that I'm also linked to them mm-hmm. by. And when you're sort of feeling that one of your identities is kind of demanding that you go out and conquer people of some other identity, I think it's as well to remind yourself of the other identities that you have that might be a basis of solidarity with the people that you're currently campaigning against. So I think the great danger of our current state of political identity is that they've sort of, a long time ago, before all this, I coined the expression going imperial.
Mm-hmm.
Identities sometimes go imperial. They sort of take over the whole of your life. They take over from all the other things that actually matter to you. And they get in the way then of being able to make these links. So I think that's one thing we can try to do is to remember and use our other identities. That is not just, remember them, but actually think, what can I do with people that I disagree with politically on the basis of other things? And that's a great challenge in our life because we have seen what political scientists call a great I forget what the expression they use is, but we've sort of sorted ourselves out. It's increasingly the case, more the case than it was even when I first started living in this country in the early 1980s, that we live in politically isolated worlds. Some of that has to do with the ways in which people have started living. People have moved into regions and suburbs and so on that are also more politically homogeneous. Some of it has to do with what's happened to American religious identities.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity in this country, but not just Christianity, but especially Christianity, became, with the rise of modern conservative evangelicalism, a very political form of religious identity. And it took on certain political positions, and it supported political people for political office, and it made that a sort of condition of membership. That's new, too, and two things are new about it. One is we have a strong, long tradition of radical Protestantism in this country that's left. The idea that evangelicalism is a right-wing phenomenon would have struck, let's go back. William Wilberforce would have thought that was a very strange thing to see, since he thought that it was his evangelicalism that explained why he was against slavery, which at the time was a progressive position.
Still is, I think.
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, actually, one of the problems about the world today is that people don't realize how much slavery there still is, or that there are things that need to be done about it, but that's or things like slavery that aren't technically slavery, debt bondage and so on. So I think so one thing that's happened is that in the public mind, Christianity is associated with the right in a way that it just wasn't, say, in the 1960s. And the other thing is that these Protestant denominations have themselves become very, very reactionary. Now, I'm an ex-Anglican, but I do care about, since there are lots of Christians in the world, I do care that Christianity is kept in good shape, and it seems to me that it's very bad for Christianity.
I've also noticed this phenomena. You see it a lot on social media where people list their name, maybe their job, but then it's this, unending series of hashtags or other identifiers. It could be pronouns related to their gender identity. It could be political beliefs. But I wonder, And some of that is very positive, like people finally getting a voice for the identity that was suppressed or ignored for so long. But as we continue to parse ourselves into ever more particular identities, can we still maintain some kind of collectivism?
Good. So I think that that's where we should remember the point about having many identities. The thing that made it possible to do, to build, for example, such institutions of the welfare state as we have in this country, was a sense that, as Richard Rorty used to say, no American should live like that.
Right.
Right. That we should have a baseline of care for other Americans. We disagree with them about all kinds of things. We disagree about religion. We disagree with them about all sorts of stuff. But they're our fellow citizens. And because they're our fellow citizens, there are things that we're willing to do for them. We're willing in wartime to protect each other, but that's sort of out on the extreme edge. But in everyday life, and this happens at not just at the level of the nation, but at the level of the city. You're having, I'm sure, a debate in this city about homelessness because I've only been here for a little bit. I got here yesterday, but it's very evident that you ought to be having a debate about homelessness. That debate needs the idea that these are our fellow citizens, and that if you can get that idea going, which sometimes you can, it can be very useful. And that's an identity. So American. Now, like all identities, national identities are full of contention and conflict. I think of people who've grown up here as Americans, whether they have citizenship papers or not. Other people think you're only an American if you have the right to a passport today. And that's a debate we can have. But there's a core of people who are legally present in the United States, who are entitled to a passport, many of whom were born here, who are my fellow citizens, like it or not.
But it's interesting that, of course, there were always people excluded from those various social
yes.
compacts. And it does seem like part of what we are experiencing now is a resentment of those who maybe didn't have great or any wealth or privilege, but had more than some, and are resentful of what they see as an encroachment on
yes.
that privilege.
Yes. Look, I mean, I think that, so there are people in this country who don't have a lot, and who are, and in particular, even if they have a little bit of money, they don't have a lot of social and cultural capital.
Yeah.
They didn't finish high school, or they did and they didn't go to college. They don't have a lot of connections. They can't get their kids internships at the New Yorker. But they used to have something, some of them, the white ones, which was a kind of sense that they were the archetypal definitive American, that they had, and that they could take some pride in being, as it were, representative Americans, in part because they were white. That has been eroded. Many of us don't think that it's a good idea to define American nationality in racial terms anymore. And that's right. And I don't want to make any concessions on that front. But some of these people are at the bottom of some very important hierarchies, including the hierarchies of class. And both parties, over the period that I've been in this country, have essentially done very little to deal with two things. One is the fact that we've seen trillions of dollars of new wealth in the United States, and almost none of it has gone to the bottom 80%.
Yeah.
It's not the bottom 15%, it's the bottom 80% has seen very little of it. That's bad. Second, automation and globalization have displaced a lot of people. And in a society that thought of them, the people displaced, as our fellow Americans, we would have been thinking about how to reshape the economy so that there were meaningful jobs for them to do. Or maybe we would be having a serious debate about basic income and guaranteeing people a decent standard of living, whether they got a job or not. Nobody's doing that. I mean, the Democratic Party isn't doing it. The Republican Party certainly isn't doing it. It's a failure of elite reflection. And I would say it's not just a failure of political elites. It's a failure of the intelligentsia. It's a failure of university elites. It's a failure of people with lots and lots of cultural capital who should have been thinking about these things. A few were, but almost nothing has been done about it. And I have been thinking that we should do something about it for a very long time.
Right.
You're listening to cultural theorist, philosopher, and writer Kwame Anthony Appiah, whose new book is The Lies That Bind. He's joined in conversation by Clara Jeffrey on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I didn't decide that we should do something about it because I thought that if we did something about it, a few of them would stop voting for Donald Trump. I think we should do something about it, and if they want to go on for voting for Donald Trump, I still think we should do something about it. I wish they wouldn't, but that's a separate question. However, I do think that if we had been doing something about it, it is probably the case that Donald Trump would seem less appealing, in part because that sense of going backwards and of not being cared about produces an attitude to the elites that essentially means that anything the elites are predominantly in favor of is regarded with skepticism. And that's one of the reasons why I think there's now skepticism about globalization. It's not because people have followed complicated economic arguments. I don't understand them, and I'm quite smart, all the economic arguments about globalization. It's that they know that the people in New York and San Francisco are in favor of it, mm-hmm. the people who run the banks and the corporations. And they think that that's a sort of prima facie reason for thinking there must be something wrong with it. And then that turns into also... That combined with racial animus, which manifests itself in anti-immigrant feeling, these are all, I think, reflexes that from people who are, there are lots of Republicans, and many of the Republicans are voting for Donald Trump because of taxes and things like that. But I'm talking about part of the American working class that seems to me to have been essentially betrayed. And that's made them very skeptical of elite projects, including the completely justified elite project of getting rid of racism, homophobia, sexism, transphobia, and all those things, which I'm not going to back off from. I mean, I think we should, we've made very good progress on those things. We need to make more. I'm all behind that. But I think what we haven't done is to deal with the problems of, that I think of as problems of class at all. We've done very little on that front. One statistic that always stuns me when I think about it, the top 30, top most highly ranked colleges in this country, roughly, it's not all of them, and for some reason Harvard wasn't included in this study, but take more kids from the top 1% of the population in income than they do from the bottom 60.
Well, that's a really interesting point. I mean, do you think that universities should be pressured to end legacy admissions?
Yes.
Do you think, as a professor at a university, I'm sure...
We don't have a lot of that. I've taught at Harvard and Princeton and Yale, so
yeah.
I have been at places that have a lot of that. I'm not trying to excuse myself by happening... But the fact is that because NYU has only recently entered the elite of these, we don't have that kind of alumni body. So we were a commuter school until the late 60s. So yes, but that's a tiny part of what needs to happen. Because the degree to which we're not a meritocracy is so shocking when you actually look at the numbers and the data. It's just unbelievable that the fiction that we're a meritocracy is maintained. I gave a talk to this effect to a bunch of people at Goldman Sachs the other day who were a bit surprised. It's overwhelmingly clear that social advantage is being hoarded by the top 20% in some things, 1% in some things, 0.01% in other things.
You wrote about Michael Young, who on the one hand was a beneficiary of a sort of early idea of meritocracy, but who also recognized that it was morphing and calcifying into a new form of class structure. Mm. Can you Can you say more about that? And also, you talk about a certain smugness that has come with that,
yes.
that maybe, I'm not so sure the people with baronial estates weren't also smug, but smug in a different way.
Well, yeah, but the people with baronial estates, at least they knew that they hadn't done anything to earn anything. I mean, they've just been, I like to say that being born to a duchess is not an achievement. It's the duchess's achievement, but it's not yours. What's happened with meritocracy as a kind of ideology is that we've got a society which is increasingly unequal, which has, and it's unequal in a very bizarre way because a very large proportion of the new wealth has gone to a very, very tiny number of people. It's not even the 1%. It's kind of 0.01%. It's a very, very tiny concentration. But that also has been in the top 20% of the population, some accumulation. So we're very unequal. And if people had thought of these inequalities as just the result of being born into privilege, they would at least be perhaps a little bit coy about it. But because we sell this as meritocracy, they feel, okay, you know, I won in a fair game. So everything I've got, my yachts and my helicopters and my 800, my $80 million apartment and all that's just perfectly fair that I have all this. And so there's and Michael Young wrote about this in Britain, but it's true here as well. The kind of smugness about wealth has developed because the ideology of meritocracy has made it look like this is earned, fair. Now, it's earned in the technical sense that most of it is not stolen, but that's because the law is fixed to is allows all kinds of things that probably shouldn't be allowed.
You know, we have a new varietal of that kind of smugness, I think, here in Silicon Valley, where it is very much this idea that, of course, I got to where I am by my smarts, and that ignore the fact that there's no diversity in these companies, and that we're ripping down industries and destroying people's jobs to like liberate something. I'm wondering, but that's only really one generation old, the sort of Silicon Valley billionaires, you know, maybe two now. How can we, with them, with the Goldman Sachs bros, others, how can we convince people that sort of hoarding educational and other resources is deleterious to society and, like, ultimately, I don't know if we'll get to tumbrils, but, you know, right. Ultimately to all of us?
There's various ways. I mean, I'm a philosopher. I like to give people reasons for things. How much difference reasoning with people about these things makes is a question on which my wise mother was extremely skeptical. So I can give reasons. Mm-hmm. I mean, here's a very simple reason. Take the $80 million apartment. If we had reasonably progressive tax system, there wouldn't be many $80 million apartments. But the people at the top would still have the best apartments. Right. It's just they wouldn't have to pay $80 million for them. If you want to have a Lamborghini, fine. But if you're going to have a Lamborghini, you need roads. If you have a Lamborghini, you need better roads than if you have a regular car. So if you're not going to allow your money to be spent on public infrastructure, your Lamborghini isn't going to be any use to you. So I think there are lots of things where you can just say, actually, it would be better for you, mm-hmm. selfishly, it would be better for you if we had a more progressive tax system. But I think also you have to use this other thing. You have to say, look, this is a republic that we're running together. It's our republic. It's not your republic. And it has to be run in a way that's in the interest of everybody. That doesn't mean that everybody has to have exactly the same amount of anything. We need financial incentives to get people to do things. I'm completely down with that. But we don't need the ones we've got. We certainly don't need the extent of it that we've got. And to the extent that we finally convince people come to be convinced, and 80% of the population is entitled to be convinced, that the system is actually rigged against them, you're going to run into problems of political legitimacy. You're going to run into problems of whether we can go on having a relatively safe society for all these rich people, and, I mean, or for anybody else. Now, I'm not predicting revolution, but I do think that when you get to the point when the system loses legitimacy, street crime goes up, burglary goes up, life becomes less pleasant for absolutely everybody. So I think there's arguments of justice and morality here, but there's also arguments of self-interest that it's better. People would be overall better off with a fairer system. Just take education. We have actually a very good university system in this country, and believe it or not, it's not all in the top 30 institutions that everybody's massively competing to get into. You can get a very good education in this country in literally hundreds and hundreds of institutions. So you don't actually have to make sure that your kid gets into Harvard for your kid to get a really good education. And if you did, the right thing to do would be to be urging state legislatures to increase support for state universities and so make sure that there were adequate opportunities for everybody, including your children, if they didn't get into Harvard. So, or NYU, I mean, don't let me pick on Harvard, everybody always does. So I think we can make reasonable arguments to people that this kind of hoarding is not, in the end, good for people in general. And remember, I mean, the hoarding, I forget how many people Harvard admits every year, but it's not very many. So in a way, our focus on those institutions is a bit distorting because most of the kids that go to college in this country don't go to those places that we've heard of. And as I say, many of them are just fine. And given that some of them aren't fine, the right thing to do about that is not to compete for the scarce resource of a good education. It's to make a good education more widely available. It's to make the bottom ones better, which you can do. So I do think attention to these questions is very important. I think that we can make good arguments. But in the end, the main argument, I think, is that living in a juster society is good for everybody. I don't mean instrumentally good. I mean you should want to be the kind of person that lives in a just society. That's the only moral attitude.
Well, how do we reward things other than birthright or hoarded educational access? I mean, I grew up in a tradition that rewarded, such as Quakers reward anything for doing good works. But, you know, society at large mostly rewards greed or even getting so rich that you can then bestow your benevolent, money onto good works. But it's not so much the ordinary people. We don't tend to honor ordinary people doing simple good things.
So this is the other side of Michael Young's great insight. It's that the way we allocate what are the main social rewards? They're basically two. One's money and the other's esteem, honor, respect. I mean, there are others, but those are the two main ones. The way we allocate them is completely inconsistent with the most important insight, I think, of the long tradition of ethical thought in the West, which is that people are different, that everybody has excellences and deficiencies, and that your task is not to be better than your neighbor, it's to be the best you can be. And some of being the best you can be is no doubt competitive, but a lot of it isn't. And that means that there's plenty of scope for respecting lots and lots of different kinds of lives. The main damage that class does is to raise people who don't have a lot of social, cultural, or financial capital to think, to look down on themselves, to lack self-respect. And as John Rawls, no radical, said, the social bases of self-respect are one of the great things that a society has to guarantee to everybody if it can. So I know we need to do that. How we do it, you asked me, the question you asked me was how to do it. I'm not sure. But the first thing in these things is to get clear that what we need to be doing. And that's something that we need to be doing. And Michael Young went to a school, Dartington Hall, which was started by radical philanthropists in England, though the wife, Dorothy Elmhurst, was the daughter of about the sixth richest American, so she had plenty of money to spend on it. And at that school, they taught people, and I think this is something that he took into his life, that everybody had to find their excellence, mm-hmm. and that it would be different for everybody. So they taught everything, gardening, pottery, algebra, French, Greek, anything. And some people, they were well regarded in school because they were just nice people. That was an that's an achievement. Being a nice person turns out to be harder than you might think. So I think running a society, an education system, raising our children to think that like that, to think it's not about being better than other people. It's about being a good me. It's about being me in a good way. Mm-hmm. And me is different from you. There's no, the fact that I'm a better philosopher than you shouldn't worry you at all, because you're not a philosopher. And if I am, I don't know whether I'm a better philosopher than you.
I think you're on safe ground there. So it's not every day that a moral philosopher is a main character in a sitcom.
A black moral philosopher, by the way, in an American sitcom.
And it's a kind of a running gag on that show that everybody hates moral philosophers because they're always hitting you with conflicting theories of ethics and a lot of citations rather than just plain advice. But you may or may not do that, but you also write The Ethicist, where you do hand out advice. And I'm wondering, was that in conflict with the more theoretical philosophy that you do? And also, just how do you pick which stories, which inquiries to answer?
While I'm thinking about the answer to the first question, the answer to the second question is I don't. My editor sends me all the questions that she thinks have any ethical content, and I answer all of them. It's been very interesting. I started 3 years ago. In September 2015, I just checked before I came here, was the first column. And I wasn't sure what was going to happen because you're right, we don't normally give any kind of advice, let alone good advice. We normally articulate theories, which you can then take away and supposedly use to run your life yourself. But I found that the tools that I have acquired in an adult life, mostly doing philosophy, turn out to be useful for thinking about problems. And I try to answer the problems using the tools without drawing too much attention to the tools. I don't name the tools. I just use them. Mm-hmm. And that's been very interesting for me. So I've learned a lot from it because I've learned to see, for example, two things I've learned. One is questions about what you can say to who or to whom, as my English teacher would have said in high school, are really interesting and important, and they preoccupy an awful lot of people. But they're right to. Mm-hmm. All of us know things about other people's lives that it might be interesting for third parties to know as well. Should we tell them?
Right.
Well, it depends on lots of things. Our relationships, issues of confidentiality, respect for privacy, secrecy, and so on. These are all important ideas, and I get asked a lot of questions about them, and I hadn't thought about them too deeply before I got asked about them. And I learned something, which is that this is a very important topic in ethics. Second thing that I've learned is that something that I think of as a great insight of the Confucian intellectual tradition, which I wasn't trained in, is absolutely right. And the great insight, I think, of the Confucian tradition is that a lot of what we owe to people, it's obvious once you articulate it, but it wasn't articulated at all clearly in any of the traditions that we call Western philosophy until recently, that a lot of what we owe to other people just depends on what relationships we're in with them. You know, Confucius talks about emperors and subjects, older brothers and younger brothers, parents and children, filial piety, talks about friends. All these relationships make a huge difference to what you owe to people. If somebody's your friend, there are things that you can't do to them that you could do to a stranger, mm-hmm. and there are things you must do for them that you don't have to do for strangers. Now, that's obvious once you say it, but I think It turns out to be a theoretically interesting question, how to handle that fact. Mm-hmm. And so I've learned a lot by just being presented with these problems. And as I say, one of the things I've learned is that it'd be better if we taught more Chinese philosophy as well as Western philosophy.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is cultural theorist, philosopher, and writer Kwame Anthony Appiah, whose new book is The Lies That Bind. He's joined in conversation by Clara Jeffrey. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I was interested in your argument that many of the ideas that we have about identity are relatively recent ones. So let's tackle maybe the trickiest. What is race? Or maybe it's easier to ask, what is race not?
So like all these identities, race begins with labeling. And the thing that's distinctive about... And so races are kinds of people. Mm-hmm. Where a kind of person is defined in part by ancestry. So, and we've had those all along,
right?
The Greeks and the Trojans, the Philistines and the Canaanites and the Medes and the Persians and so on. We've had those all along. But what two things happened in the 18th century and then, well, one happened in the 18th, one happened in the 19th century, roughly, in the development of ideas about these things in the North Atlantic world. One was... people came to think that the world was divided in an important way into a very small number of these. Mm. If you read the Torah, or more broadly, if you read the whole of the Tanakh, the whole of what Christians call the New Testament, the Old Testament, it's full of hundreds and hundreds of kinds of people. They did not think that the world was divided into five kinds. It's true that there are the descendants of Ham, Shem, and Japheth, the children of Noah. But by the time you get into real history, that's not very important. So one thing was this idea developed, as you know, in the age of European exploration, the Europeans are discovering the globe. They're classifying people in these very, very high-level classifications. Black, you know, Asian, Negro, Caucasian, Amerindian. Very, very high-level classifications. And they think that those are quite... that within those, people are pretty homogeneous, right? Which none of the ancient Jewish thinkers thought that all the children of Japheth were exactly the same as each other, more or less. And nor did the ancient Greeks, nor did Herodotus. So that's one big thing that happens in the 18th century, and it's clearly connected with the rise of European empire and the slave trade. Second thing in the 19th century is that with the rise of science, and of particularly of human biology, at whose heart is the idea that we're just another animal, which is not an idea that the religious traditions had at all, people come to think that this classification into a small number is based in bodies and in things inherited in bodies, in things that biologists can study. By the end of the 19th century, we call these genes, but at the beginning of the 19th century, they didn't have a name for them. Now, what's interesting, I think, is that... by the late 19th century, it was pretty clear that the idea that these classifications were in fact based in the body was mistaken. It was pretty clear that W.B. Du Bois knew this, and he was already out of college by 1900.
Right.
So that way of thinking about humans, classifying them into these small number of groups and thinking that it's all about the bodily difference, inherited difference, was under attack, you know, already by the beginning of the 20th century. But it hasn't gone away. You only have to read... you just have to look at the web. You just have to look at Twitter and those places.
Well, let's discuss Elizabeth Warren then, because, you know, in trying to kind of get out in front of Trump's racist Pocahontas meme, she somewhat mystifyingly, I think, invoked genetic evidence of some Native ancestry, but... in so doing, like, offended the Cherokee tribal roles in history, how they consider tribal membership, and I mean, I have a whole bunch of thoughts on why this was not handled well politically.
Yes.
But what does this incident say to you about still the way we're navigating this idea of biology and race or genetics and race.
So I actually think that the sort of intellectual move she made was perfectly respectable. It wasn't about race. It was about, but it was about biology.
Right.
And the biological idea was, and this is just true, there are some sequences of DNA, some so-called haplotypes, which are common in some populations and rare or non-existent in others. If you find someone has one of these haplotypes, then you know something about their ancestry, namely that they come from a group in which that haplotype exists.
Right.
And if it turns out to be a haplotype that doesn't exist in any other group, then you know that they came from that group. So I know, and actually almost everybody with an English ancestor knows, that they're descended from Edward II. 99% of the people of Britain and who have ancestry in Britain 100 years ago are descended from Edward
II. Is this like a Genghis Khan situation? Was he procreating all over the place? Or?
It's just that it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And 800 years ago is 40 generations. And 2 to the 40 is a number too big for me to spend time trying to calculate or report to you. And that's the number of places on the family tree 40 generations back. So given the number of people who were around at the time of Edward II, which wasn't a great number, those places on the family tree all have to be populated over and over again by some of the same people. And it turns out that kings get to populate larger sections than everybody else. Everybody, we're all descended from, what's his name, Charlemagne as well. And Genghis Khan is the ancestor of, most of the people of Central Asia. One of the thousands and thousands and thousands of ancestors. So if there is a haplotype that is to be found in the Cherokee population and not much anywhere else, and if you have it, it's probably quite likely that you had Cherokee ancestors. That part, I think, is intellectually okay. That's the basis of 23andMe. I wish 23andMe were more historically sophisticated. I think that some of the ways they do these things are a bit silly. But the basic idea is sound. The mistake, of course, is precisely because that biological question is not a question about identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a question about the identity of your ancestors, but it's not a question about your identity because the Cherokee Nation gets to decide who's a Cherokee. Under American law, they get to decide. Mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of custom or politeness, right?
Right.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs gives the Cherokee Nation, as a domestic dependent sovereign, the right to decide their own criteria of membership, and they have criteria of membership which exclude Elizabeth Warren.
Yep.
So I think that's, as it were, how I see the situation. Now, I think we're going to agree that it was handled extremely badly.
I mean, you could have gotten some buy-in from the Cherokee, whatever you were going to say.
Yes, you could have said,
is this the way I should present it?
Yes, and you could have said, all I'm saying is there's pretty good evidence that the story that has been passed down in my family, which is an idea that Cherokee people respect, the idea of family oral tradition, the story has been in my family, which the president said what I was lying about, turns out to be confirmed by this other form of evidence. And it could be handled better. But I want to insist that the valid point that was being made by the biologist who helped her was not a point about race at all.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the question of anybody's racial identity.
So this question of racial identity exists in a backdrop of, kind of ever-changing ideas of who is white.
Yes.
Italians, Jews, Slavs, even Irish weren't really considered to be white 100 years ago, 200 years ago. And some people are positing that although we can't quite see it now, that one of the things we're seeing is that white privilege is being conferred, at least to a certain extent, on some folks that it wouldn't have been conferred on before, maybe if you're biracial or well-educated enough or rich enough or whatever. And it's sort of what you were saying earlier about how you have a buffer that others do not. And I'm where do you think this is headed for us?
I don't know. But I do think that the young people in my classes anyway, who are, of course, educated
mm-hmm.
people, because you get into NYU, you have to be pretty well educated, are much more fluid about these things than some of their ancestors in the last generation and the generation before. How it's going to turn out is going to depend on lots of things, including maybe some things that are happening right now, some things to do with whether we're going to go backwards into more racialized forms of thinking, which I was thinking we might have been getting away from.
Yeah.
So I don't know what's going to happen. But one of the points I wanted to make in the book is that here's what we know, that at the beginning of the 18th century, that way of thinking was just not established in Europe. And I tell the story of a Ghanaian, I mean, he wasn't Ghanaian because the Ghana didn't exist, but he would have been Ghanaian if he'd been born where he was born today, who was taken, probably as an enslaved person, to Europe, became the godson of a German prince, and was educated with his children, and became a professor of philosophy in Germany at the time of Kant in the 18th century, and rector of the university, and you know, did all sorts of things, and then he went back home to Ghana and retired. And that was only possible at that point because people didn't think that black people were so different that you couldn't educate them up to do that kind of thing. And then in the 19th century, that doesn't happen very much.
Yeah.
So just to draw the QED, so we could have a system like that. We could have a system where we didn't have all these assumptions about what people are like on the basis of assuming that there's five kinds of people and they're all very different from each other, and some people just can't do math, and other people just can't do music, and so on.
You know, you talk about how nations are made, not, you know, it's an act of will. And ours was made haltingly and imperfectly on the idea of e pluribus unum from many one. So against the forces of white nationalism that we're seeing today, how do we defend that idea? Or are we seeing a fundamental mismatch between the ideas of nationhood and something more akin to statehood?
Yeah, we need, I think, the theorists who produced the nation state, that hyphenated thing, we're onto something. A modern state is a community of strangers. We just can't know. There's 330 million Americans. We can't know each other. Even the smallest countries in the world now are too big for everybody in them to know each other. Aristotle's Athens, the elite men, the free men, could actually all meet each other. They could actually gather together in a place, and so when they were doing politics, they were making decisions about people on the basis of knowing their individual characters. We can't do that, and we can't go back to that, right? We can't run the world in communities of a few thousand people, giving total sovereignty to a few thousand people at a time. We just can't coordinate the world. So we have to have states, at least one. I mean, we could have a mega state, but we need states. If we the insight of the nation state people was, you have to have some imaginative identification if you're going to run a system of strangers on that scale, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a nation is. It's a way of imagining a political entity that can do things together. And it does not have to be defined by descent. It can be a civic nation. It can be defined by constitutional matters. It can be defined in all kinds of ways. But you do need some sense of us, we, the people, as well as some sense of the state and the institutions and so on. And you need to have ways of creating a sense of usness in order to make these units work. Now, we do it at lots of levels. We do it. I have a small farm in Pennington, New Jersey. The population of Pennington is a couple of thousand people. We run a great high school. and the school board is elected by just a few thousand people. So it's more like Athens. So sometimes you can do that in the modern world. But for much of what we need to do, and especially the big things like global warming and coordination of trade and so on, we need big stuff, and we need to be able to imagine ourselves together. And that's what nations are for. And so the idea, now the idea that nations are, as it were, naturally homogeneous, that's just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
1870, the typical Frenchman spoke French, but a third of the population of France didn't speak French. So if you want to have a country that's culturally one, a minimum condition of that, I would have thought, is that you all speak the same language.
Right. You quote another, I think, philosopher in saying that forgetting, and I would even say historical error, is an essential element in the creation of a nation. I think what that means is that you have to sort of forget some of the worst things that the nation did to become a nation. But how can we do that while also acknowledging the things that are horrible that created this nation, and while we're determined, as it were, you know, to never forget those kind of atrocities?
So that was Ernest Renan, and he was talking about France. And he was a French patriot, a great French historian, and actually quite politically conservative. He was saying that if you're going to have a national story, it's going to have stuff that you keep in, and it's going to have stuff that you keep out. You can't remember everything.
Right.
And I think that in that famous essay, which is called What is a Nation, he missed something, which is that we don't actually have to have one story, just one story. It may be that we need a sort of central story that guides our main thinking when we're doing things together as Americans, but we can relate differently to the history of the United States and still be patriotic and loyal to our country. So yes, we're bound to forget some things, and I think in a proper, respectful society, we'll understand that, for example, African Americans are not going to forget that Thomas Jefferson was a slaveholder, even though he wrote beautiful words about freedom. I myself think there's no need to forget that about Thomas Jefferson, that we can understand, because we all don't live up to our best selves, how you could be someone who writes beautiful words and even sometimes believes beautiful words about freedom, but can't quite let yourself stop the pleasures of being allowed to have enslaved people and making your life comfortable. I think that's not too hard to understand. But so we'll have different relations to it. But we can't tell the whole thing, right? And so Renan's right about that, because the whole thing is fantastically complicated and has many, many highways and byways. It has atrocities against American Indians. It has enslavement. It has the execution of homosexuals in colonial America. It has all sorts of horrible things in it. And then it has some wonderful things too. But we can't, as it were, teach our children all of it. So we have to teach them just some of it. And in teaching them some of it, surely we want to teach them at least some things that will make them feel good about the country. Because that's what we need. We need to feel good about the country so we can do things together.
Well, I'd like to thank you all for attending, and to thank Kwame Anthony Appiah. As I'm sure you have grasped already, we've only just touched on many of the ideas in this really lovely written book.
thank you.
The Lies of Vine. Thanks very much.
Thank you for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was very fun.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was cultural theorist, philosopher, and writer Kwame Anthony Appiah, whose new book is The Lies That Bind. He was joined in conversation by Clara Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of Mother Jones. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamantuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.